Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Eastern Kentuckians talk about their future.
Part of what SOAR needs to mean is more than just investments in economic diversification, but it's got to mean investments in economic transformation.
While the struggle to find jobs for laid-off coal miners continues.
They're not at all unaccustomed to layoffs, but typically those layoffs have been shorter and the phone would ring a lot sooner and they go back to work.
And an ultra marathoner runs his way to good health.
Trail running's my specialty, although I do compete in some of the major road races.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Eastern Kentuckians are ready to talk about the future. This was evident this past Monday when more than 1,500 people showed up in Pikeville for the first SOAR, the Shaping Our Appalachian Region Summit. WMMT's Sylvia Ryerson was at the event and has this story.
Ray Tucker made the trip to SOAR all the way from Pulaski County and was one of hundreds in the lobby of the Pikeville Expo Center on Monday morning, ready to dig in to the day's agenda.
It's exciting. I got up at 5 o'clock this morning and got here really excited about the day to see these people here and what's going on.
The morning session included opening remarks from the summit's bipartisan conveners, Governor Steve Beshear and Congressman Hal Rogers, as well as Speaker of the House Greg Stumbo and President of the Senate Robert Stivers. As Governor Beshear outlined the reasons for calling the summit,
"This situation has reached a critical point. Coal has long been a foundation of this region's economy, and it will continue in that role for decades to come. But there should be no doubt in anybody's mind that its role as an employer is reducing. Changing market conditions, as well as stricter environmental regulations, are influencing the way this nation produces and consumes energy. That's a fact. And to ignore that is to blindfold ourselves and stick our heads in the sand. The need to diversify this economy has never been greater."
As a model to look to for examples of success from another mining region in transition, the day featured an extensive presentation by Joe and Tony Sertich, a father and son duo from the Iron Range of northeastern Minnesota. Both Joe Sertich's father and grandfather were Minnesota iron ore miners, and after going away from home to teach, Joe came back in 1979, and at first,
things were really looking good, but then the bottom fell out. And this isn't the first time it happened, so people weren't really surprised. But at the same time, we had newspaper headlines like the ones you see here, where families are facing an uncertain future. Mining companies reduced their employment in a matter of about a year and a half from 16,000 miners to 5,000 miners. This is devastation. This is pain. This is psychologically, it's very, very difficult to deal with.
One of the key players in this moment of economic crisis was the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board, of which Joe Sertich's son, Tony, is now the commissioner. IRRB for short. This board was first established by the state back in the 1940s to help with the boom and bust cycle of mining in rural northeastern Minnesota. Yet although IRRB is a state agency, it receives no state funding. Rather, it is entirely funded from the tax on the region's mined resources. And as Joe Sertich explained, this is possible because...
"And we're very fortunate that these resources that are mined in northeastern Minnesota, the value of the resource, the tax on the resource, primarily stays in the region that is most impacted by it. The taxing from the mining revenue in Minnesota, almost two-thirds of it stays in our local region. Now, the state gets their cut as well, but most of the revenue from this resource stays within our region to reinvest in our region. And we have, and just to put a little perspective yearly, our annual budget at the IRRB is $37 million. And then in the 1970s, folks thought about the end. They said, you're mining this non-renewable resource, and eventually you're going to deplete it all, or it's going to be not economically viable to take it out of the ground. So they started taking a portion of the yearly fund and putting it in a rainy day trust fund. And they called the trust fund the 2002 fund back in the 1970s, because they said, really smart people thought about this and thought, you'll be mining at least until 2002. And so we should at least have a rainy day fund built up until then. Well, I'm here to tell you, we're still mining long and strong, and it's still our major piece of our economy. But that trust fund that was started in the 1970s has now grown to $142 million. Now, we use the interest off of that trust fund to fund our yearly projects, but we have a nest egg in place now, a rainy day fund that will never go away, we hope.
It's been used since to invest in a wide variety of locally owned businesses, community infrastructure, and workforce development. And back in the 1980s, when the industry collapsed and thousands of miners were laid off, leaders used money from the trust fund and...
We established a jobs program that kept those unemployed people from leaving our region, and they worked on public works projects all across our region. So bettered our communities, it kept them there, made sure they got a paycheck instead of an unemployment check, and kept a vast majority of them in our region.
Currently in Kentucky, only half of the severance tax on mined coal returns to the coal-producing counties, and there is no permanent coal severance trust fund for the future. However, a report published in 2012 by the Mountain Association for Community Economic Development and the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy estimated that even a permanent fund started now, involving a 1% severance tax, could grow to $735 million by 2035 and be able to pay annual dividends of $31 million in current dollars, at that time just using Eastern Kentucky revenue, which could be used for investments in education and economic development. For Ray Tucker, many of these ideas hit home.
You know, the stories are the same, and if we can put it together and actually build a diverse economy, I think we'll actually have a brighter future. I really like the idea of the hands-on colleges in engineering. If you want to learn how to do a job, you've got to get out there and do it. And that's what their engineering program does. It puts people in the place where businesses actually happen and where real-world problems are needing to be solved. And I think that's great. I'd love to see it even in our middle schools and high schools. We have real-world problems that need solving. We could have middle school and high school students working to solve mine reclamation issues. All the things that, you know, they could be out there in the field learning stuff.
Joe and Tony Sertich also shared several stories of small businesses that IRRRB invested in that have since become very successful.
What I like about those stories, starting with Ryan, is there's an example of, and Tony says it best, he'd rather start businesses right in the region and grow them from 2 to 17 and do that 100 times than go find one big employer that's going to bring 300 or 400 jobs in.
To Justin Maxson, president of the Mountain Association for Community Economic Development, and a member of the 41-person SOAR Planning Committee, this kind of new approach to thinking about what economic development even looks like in eastern Kentucky must be at the heart of any strategy for success.
Part of what SOAR needs to mean is more than just investments in economic diversification, but it's got to mean investments in economic transformation, that we need to use it to create a new sense of politics. We have to make sure that we're lifting up development options that create locally held wealth and build people's sense of hope in what's possible. And we have to make sure SOAR doesn't just promote any job as a good job, but that SOAR promotes building jobs that create opportunity and build a stronger, better, more diverse, and sustainable economy.
Carl Shoup is a retired coal miner from Harlan County and a member of Kentuckians for the Commonwealth. And as Shoup sees it...
You know, not only in eastern Kentucky do we have to diversify our economy and try to get some different industry and different things going here in eastern Kentucky, but one thing that we got to keep in mind, too, that we got to diversify our leadership in eastern Kentucky. You know, this region has been and is I hate to say it, but, you know, it has a history of cronyism big time. And we need some honest and courageous leaders today, because we need some courageous decisions to be made if we're going to survive here in eastern Kentucky.
And according to Maxson, there's a lot of reasons why the rest of the state and the country should be paying attention to what's happening right now in Appalachia.
Eastern Kentucky and Central Appalachia were critical to the industrialization of the U.S. You know, the coal that was mined in the region for, you know, 80 years was critical to steel mills, to the electrification of the U.S., that people sacrificed their health and their homes for coal. And I think it's important that story is told and that the rest of the state and the rest of the country understands the cost that extraction meant to the region. Two is, I think there's an economic argument for the rest of the state of Kentucky. If we invest smarter in eastern Kentucky in a way that over time addresses some of the challenges, their economic upsides to the rest of the state.
For Ivy Brashear of Perry County, SOAR is an opportunity for the beginning of a new kind of conversation.
This is a really key moment to bring lots of different people together, not just one side against another side, but it's a time to come together as one community, one region. And I think times of crisis sort of bring out collaboration and spirit of reconciliation.
Reporting for WMMT in Whitesburg, I'm Sylvia Ryerson.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. While some residents, politicians, and community leaders gathered in Pikeville to ponder eastern Kentucky's future, others are dealing firsthand with the effects of a declining coal economy. For decades, eastern Kentucky has been defined by the industry. But now, more than 6,000 coal miners have been laid off in the past 2 years, and a lot of those mines have permanently closed. As the region's economy struggles to reinvent itself, many are asking, what's next? WFPL's Erica Peterson went to eastern Kentucky to see.
People in eastern Kentucky are used to the ups and downs of a coal-based economy. Prices plummet, production slows down, coal miners get laid off. Several months later, prices rise, the phone rings, miners pick up their helmets and go back to work. We're in one of those slumps now, but this time, things are different. In the hardest hit counties, the bumpers of heavy-duty Ford pickup trucks still host Friends of Coal license plates, next to stickers telling other drivers that coal keeps the lights on. But the winding mountain roads are a little bit quieter. You can drive miles without seeing one of the lumbering coal trucks that, for years, carried the region's resources away.
104.
About 150 laid-off coal miners are sitting in the convention center in downtown Harlan. Nearly all are men, many still wearing the uniform from their previous job. Heavy pants and shirts with orange reflective stripes. The men stare straight ahead, waiting for their number.
105.
They're waiting to interview for coal mining jobs, but not here. Eastern Kentucky mines aren't hiring. These jobs are a five-hour drive away at one of Patriot Coal's mines in western Kentucky.
My name is Gary Cox, Harlan, Kentucky. Former coal miner, hoping to find a job. We've exhausted everything in eastern Kentucky. It's time to go west and hope for the best.
Gary Cox is one of the youngest men in the room, 24, and wearing a camouflage print hat with Friends of Coal on it. He spent 3.5 years as an underground coal miner until he was laid off about a year ago. He's been looking for work since, and even went back to school for an associate's degree. But his unemployment runs out this month.
Going west is my last resort, but it's come to it. There's nothing here. I don't know if I'm more scared of not getting a job or getting a job.
Yeah, I'm Wes Smith, fourth generation coal miner. My son will be a fifth generation. Harlan County, Kentucky, born and bred.
Wesley Smith is in the same position, even though he's farther along in his career than Cox. He's 42, and he spent 20 of those years working in underground mines. The name of his baby son, Aiden, is tattooed across his neck. Smith pulls up his shirt to show me a picture of his oldest son tattooed on his chest.
This is Little Wes. That's the oldest one.
Little Wes isn't so little anymore. He's a coal miner, too. Until last March, Big Wes was commuting 2 hours each way to a mine in Virginia. Then he was laid off.
I'm a foreman, got all kinds of time, you know, and training, and can't buy a job right now.
At least not in eastern Kentucky. And no matter how bad things have been in the region, they'll probably get worse. From January 2012 to June 2013, U.S. power plants bought more than 41 million tons of eastern Kentucky coal. But the first wave of stricter air regulations is scheduled to go into effect in 2016. These regulations put new limits on the amount of mercury and other toxic pollution plants can emit. Of the 89 plants that bought eastern Kentucky coal in the past 18 months, about a third have announced they'll retire or switch to gas. Several others say they plan to stop burning Appalachian coal entirely. That's a 35% drop in the already reduced demand for eastern Kentucky coal over the next 2 years. And these changes have already been set in motion. There's no turning back. For Wesley Smith, that's hard to imagine.
It's worse than it's ever been. I'm fourth generation coal miner, and so I've been seeing it since the 70s, you know, that I can remember, and I've never seen it like this, you know.
It's really a moving target.
Michael Cornett works for the Eastern Kentucky Concentrated Employment Program. For the past 9 months, he's been running an initiative called Hiring Our Miners Every Day, or HOME.
When we first applied for our national emergency grant late last year, we were looking at around 2,000 layoffs, and that was a crisis.
Now, estimates show anywhere from 6,000 to 8,000 Eastern Kentucky miners are laid off. Cornett and his organization are trying to spend the $5.2 million grant they got from the U.S. Department of Labor to help laid-off coal miners and their families. So far, they've enrolled 1,400. Some are going back to school, some are in apprenticeships, and some have gotten help to relocate for other jobs. They want to help every miner who is out of work. But strangely, that's actually easier said than done.
The reality is that it's a difficult switch in this culture to get people to consider other alternatives.
For miners to dedicate time to school or retraining programs, or to even think about moving away, they have to accept that what's going on is different from the economic slumps of the past.
This is a culture that is used to the coal industry waxing and waning through the years. They're not at all unaccustomed to layoffs, but typically those layoffs have been shorter and the phone would ring a lot sooner and they go back to work. That's simply not happening now.
There's been a decline for years and years and years. In 89, there was mines everywhere. Every holler had mines. And now, you know, there's not a mines. None.
Even so, for Smith and Cox and the others at the job fair in Harlan County, coal is still their best hope, even if it's not coal near their homes. While the eastern Kentucky coal fields have been shrinking, production has been steadily growing in western Kentucky. Demand for that coal is up. Federal law used to favor low-sulfur Appalachian coal. But current regulations require power plants to have scrubbers to control pollution. And if every plant has a scrubber anyway, it makes more sense to burn the cheaper, high-sulfur coal from the Illinois Basin, which includes parts of western Kentucky. So, miners like Cox and Smith are drawn westward in hopes they can continue doing the only work they've been trained and paid for.
Well, yeah, I mean, where else could I go with a high school education and make $40 an hour, you know?
Coal mining is just about the only way to make a decent living in Appalachia without a college education. Gary Cox says when he was laid off with only a few years of experience, he was making nearly $25 an hour plus overtime. A decent wage anywhere, but especially in eastern Kentucky, where the cost of living is low.
You know, it was fun. See all these 18, 19-year-old boys with wads of cash. You know, how you do that, man? Hey, just climb down in that hole, all the money you can stand.
Neither Cox nor Smith wants to leave eastern Kentucky. It's where generations of their families have lived, and they feel a connection with the mountains. Leaving is the last resort. And as the coal industry has tanked over the past few years, it has these miners wondering who they should blame.
Mr. Speaker, American coal families are under attack.
Politicians have been quick to point fingers. Here's Kentucky Congressman Hal Rogers on the House floor this summer.
Not from a foreign power or a natural disaster, but by an administration that has resolutely, perversely, and now overtly proposed to end coal mining.
And Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, testifying at a hearing in D.C. over the Environmental Protection Agency's proposed limits on carbon dioxide from new power plants.
By now, it is clear that this administration and your agency have declared a war on coal. For Kentucky, this means a war on jobs and on our state's economy.
For years, rather than trying to diversify the economy or helping cushion the blow of coal's slow decline, politicians have spouted rhetoric and fought regulations. And as the bumper stickers show, the sentiments are common in eastern Kentucky, too. But while there's always something to gain from fiery speeches in Washington, a coal miner can only blame the government for so long before he has to figure out Plan B. Cox isn't a fan of the Obama administration, or of the environmental and mine safety laws he sees as putting the industry in jeopardy. But from a practical standpoint, he says it's time to move on.
I'm over the mad spell, blaming government, EPA. Being mad is, it ain't gonna do nothing. It ain't gonna help. So just have to try to adjust and adapt and just get over it, do what you have to do.
That's what Kenneth Coley is trying to do too. A few miles away from the job fair, Coley is studying at the Harlan County campus of Southeast Kentucky Community and Technical College. He's been thinking about whether mining could rebound here.
I don't see it happening. And I got out because I'm just not going to stand still and just hope for it to come back because I don't think it's going to do it.
We're sitting in a common room at the college where Coley's working toward a degree in computer numeric control. He's 43. He worked in the coal industry for 8 years as an underground miner.
I've been laid off 5 times in 3 years, and all but one have been complete mine closures.
For Coley, what's happened to eastern Kentucky is depressing. He lives in nearby Bell County in a house behind some of Appalachia's ubiquitous train tracks. Every day, he sees train car after train car of Kentucky coal passing by, much of it on its way out of the Commonwealth. The ground has been emptied. Now the towns are hollowing out, too.
Well, you're talking billions of dollars leaving this area and nothing getting put back here. I mean, that's why you lose generations of young kids in this area. I don't blame them. I left. And I would tell anybody else here that was in high school, if you want to make a living, you better leave this area because you're not going to be able to here.
After being laid off again last year, Coley decided a career in the coal industry wasn't a reliable way to support his family. So he left.
I love the job and I love coal mining, but I'm done with it now because it can't provide a life for me and my family. I have no use for it anymore.
This attitude is still rare among eastern Kentucky coal miners. The messages many miners hear from their representatives in Washington make it easy to get the sense that the coal industry will rebound once a new president and Congress take over. But that's not reality. Many factors besides regulations have sped coal's decline here, like low natural gas prices, shrinking coal reserves, and higher production costs. There will still be coal mining to some extent in eastern Kentucky, but a lot of this is a done deal, and no politician or policy is going to bring back coal's glory days. Coal is a victim of the market forces these same politicians champion in healthcare and banking. Utility companies have made multi-billion-dollar decisions to convert plants to natural gas or close coal-burning units across the country. They've told their investors, they've begun the regulatory process, and at this point, it's too late to turn back.
The coal industry is going to be with us for a long, long time, going to be a basic foundation of our economy in Kentucky for a long, long time.
That's Governor Steve Beshear in a promotional video for the summit in Pikeville this week. This sounds like the same message we've heard before, although this time, there's a twist.
But it's probably never going to employ the number of people that it does now. And now people, I think, are finally realizing that and realizing that we've got to broaden our horizons.
In Kentucky, it's still surprising to hear a political leader acknowledge the reality of what's going on in the eastern coalfields. And Michael Cornett of Home says the mixed messages make it harder to convince laid-off miners to consider careers outside of coal mining or outside of eastern Kentucky.
The best thing we can do is to sort of really rise above the politics of those situations and just deal with the realities. And the realities are those miners who are out of work.
Cornett estimates his program has 250 laid-off coal miners in classroom-based training and another 100 in apprenticeship programs with local employers. And that doesn't count people who have already found new employment outside the coal industry. Todd Howard was never a coal miner. He worked in coal mine permitting for his father's company. But the company folded in 2010, and Howard decided to pursue something different. Since then, he's been a farmer.
This is what I consider to be a typical eastern Kentucky farm. You got 80 total acres, and you got 79 of it hillside that you can't do much with.
Howard is driving down the road in Hippo, a tiny town in Floyd County. He farms about 8 acres, spread out over 4 different locations, divided among land owned by him, his neighbors, and friends. He pulls up to a tract he owns, a field surrounded by hills where he's raising 8 pigs. And even now, his present and former lives intersect. I watch as he breaks up a familiar-looking chunk of black rock and passes it to the hogs through a fence.
Are you feeding them coal?
Yeah. I never knew they would eat coal, but apparently coal has a lot of minerals in it. They love it.
And that's only one of the ways coal is still in Howard's life. He points up at the hills surrounding the pig pen. It's his land, but years ago, he leased it to a coal company.
Like I said, it was one of those things. We were still working in the coal industry, and it seemed like a good idea at the time.
Howard doesn't know whether the company will ever choose to mine there, but if they do, he'll have to move part of his farm. Now that he's in agriculture, he's concerned about the water and the effects nearby coal mining could have on his business. And, of course, there's his community. At its recent peak in 2008, there were nearly 1,100 miners in Floyd County. Now there are 500.
I have a great deal of respect for them, and I want to more than anything be supportive of what they're doing, you know? And so how do you do that, though? How do you get across to people that you have an issue with this industry, that it's not going to be here 20 years from now?
But there's a lot of work to be done before sustainable agriculture can work on a large scale in eastern Kentucky. Howard has been building the demand for his produce over the past 4 years. He also created a marketplace, the Floyd County Farmers Market.
I certainly think that sustainable agriculture has a very bright future in eastern Kentucky. It's going to take some work to take it to that next level.
During its first summer, the market did about $600 of business. 3 years later, the number was just shy of $50,000. Experiences like Howard's are giving eastern Kentucky residents hope as they contemplate the declining coal industry and wonder what's next. And some politicians are beginning to wonder, too. The goals of the summit held this week were to bring people together to discuss the region's future and to build public-private partnerships to improve eastern Kentucky's economy, education, and infrastructure. Michael Cornett of Home says this conversation is long overdue. The region's coal-based economy has declined so sharply that the problem can't be ignored anymore.
One would hope that this could have happened 20 years ago, because honestly, the writing was on the wall in many ways, and people either chose to believe it or not. But those messages have been coming through loud and clear for many years. But at least we're finally to the point where that's going to happen now.
But the million or billion dollar question is still how to revitalize eastern Kentucky's economy, beyond the Band-Aid solutions of new roads and industrial parks, which have fallen short in the past.
There has been a real downturn in the economy. I'm not denying that. I know a lot of people out there are really, really hurting, but I really think there's also a lot of optimism and hope.
Jenny Williams is a native of Hazard in Perry County. She teaches at the community college there.
And we can throw up our hands and give up, or we can pitch in and try to make it a better place. We can try to attract some more industries. We can do what we need to do to create the infrastructure that we need.
It's a few days before Hazard's annual Christmas parade, and Williams has been out with a children's program run by Pathfinders of Perry County, a nonprofit she chairs. Together, they've been festively painting shop windows along Hazard's Main Street in preparation for the parade. Now, they're at the Treehouse Cafe having dinner. Treehouse is, well, kind of hip, and it's honestly not what I expected to find in Hazard. It's owned by another Hazard native, Jennifer Noble. She says patrons are surprised to find hummus on the menu, local art on the walls, and regular open mic nights.
I lived in Somerset and the world was like completely different, and I came back home and I wanted to bring a part of what I saw there back to Hazard.
Williams's group's efforts in Hazard are small. They aren't focused on luring a new manufacturer to town or filling a business park. Instead, they're building community gardens, putting art in windows, and pushing for a walking and biking path along the river. Williams says her goal is to focus on attracting 2 key demographics to Hazard: people who have moved away and tourists, and also to make the town a more pleasant place to live for current residents.
You know, we kind of feel like if we create spaces like Treehouse, and if we, have things like art walks and things to do, that it'll hit all 3 of those target audiences and and improve economic development along the way.
Whatever the solution is, Williams says it'll have to be one that relies on multiple industries.
The people who say that agriculture is the answer are right. The people who say that tourism is the answer are right. There's no one answer. We've got to take a holistic approach and do lots of different things.
One thing everyone agrees on, fixing Eastern Kentucky won't be easy and it won't be quick. It'll take work and buy-in from locals and probably state and federal money too. And now that the summit is over, comes the real test. It's up to political, community, and business leaders to prove that, while this isn't the end of the coal industry, this is the beginning of a thoughtful, productive discussion about the region's future, rather than another empty PR effort. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Erica Peterson.
While state leaders gathered in eastern Kentucky for the first Shaping Our Appalachian Region, or SOAR, conference, the Kentucky Chamber of Commerce sponsored its annual legislative preview. Shelley Hampton, who's with the Kentucky Association of Counties, says the downturn in mining has reduced the coal severance tax paid to local governments.
You've got some counties that rely on that for as much as 40% of their operating budget. Changes do need to be made, and I'm pleased to see that the whole state is trying to focus on just the whole region in general in eastern Kentucky.
For example, the Ashland Independent newspaper reported earlier this year that Boyd County officials expect to see a 50% drop in coal severance taxes paid during the next year. And Hampton says communities like Hazard are receiving far fewer coal severance dollars.
While they're making great strides, their community college is excellent. They've got a lot going on there, but they have suffered quite a bit with the layoffs, like that whole region has. So coal severance is very important to county budgets, very important to the state as a whole.
John Steiner, who directs the Kentucky League of Cities, says some local officials would like to replace those dollars with a local sales tax. However, under current law, localities are prohibited from enacting such a tax. There are plans to introduce legislation in the Kentucky legislature to change that. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Deer hunting is a popular activity across Appalachia this time of the year. The Allegheny Front contributor Patrick Wagner reminisces about his first and only hunting trip.
I grew up in the middle of Pennsylvania, Montour County to be exact. Deer hunting was a tradition that came with the snow in this tiny spot in the north central part of the state. Some years would go by unscathed by winter storms, but more often than not, the blaze orange would be framed in white snow. My mom grew up in the middle of the woods a few counties over, in a house my grandparents built 60 years ago when they were young. That home, nestled between a hill and a creek, was the site of my first and only hunting trip, and the first trips of countless men and women in my family, dating at least back to the time when this area was the frontier. Through childhood, my grandparents' house was as close to a magical place as I knew. Countless forts had been built, bows and arrows fired, and ponds skated upon by the time I was 13. That's the age when it had become clear that I was the only one of the three grandchildren who took enough of an interest in hunting to go with my grandparents into the open space that was just out their back door. I attended hunter-trapper education classes at the 911 call center. My mom went with me, and despite that terribly awkward image in your head, it really wasn't too bad to have your mom there, even as a teenage boy. There were 10 hours of training, including a terrible video about not drinking. Also a no-no, pressuring people into letting you hunt on their property. In the end, we received our certificates. The first year was marred by the worst kind of tragedy for a kid who just sat through so many classes. My dad had waited too long to buy the license, and I was left without a few freezing hours in the woods for another year. But the next year, with the foil-covered license on my back, I went to my grandparents ready to meet the same rite of passage as many of my friends. While my grandmother Olive and I stood ready on the back porch, guns in hand, blaze orange vests and hats pulled down, my grandfather sorted through his various hunting supplies in the house, looking for a different orange hat than the one he had on. I don't think he ever found it, but we waited and waited, our breath ushering forth like two dragons. When he was done getting ready, Granddad's attire was more that of a gentleman with his broad-brimmed hat than a sniper in camouflage. While he searched, my grandma decided it would be a good idea to reinforce a few ideas about safety. We were talking casually about the safeties on my Winchester and her Remington when, with a quick flick of her finger, her gun went off, firing a bullet away from me and through the garage a few feet away. She was mortified, and so was my grandfather when he stuck his head out the door and yelled an extremely infrequent curse word. Though the incident was shrugged off as the accident it was, it remains a lesson in safety that my mom's family still remembers. The accident didn't deter us that day. We made our way to the tree stand in the middle of their woods. A short ladder led to the wooden platform, foliage only lightly hanging in the trees. We waited, and waited, and waited some more as my grandmother stood below and my grandfather stalked the woods like a spirit in the trees, like his great-great-great-grandfather had on the same ground 200 years before. Granddad performed what's known as the drive, making only enough noise to herd the whitetails in a path towards Grandma and me at the tree stand. Though we had moved deeper into the woods, the drone of Interstate 80 was still above, only dampened by the slow moan of the wind around us. Finally, we heard a shot. Perhaps another hunter, my grandmother thought, but it soon generated a few deer hurtling towards the stand from the west. I quickly aimed my gun, but the doe were too far away, covered in the dense foliage of a dry creek bed. My grandmother stayed her shot as well, and within a few minutes my grandfather appeared, claiming the gunshot as his own, though even he knew it hadn't hit its intended target. With that failed drive, we called it a day. After unloading our rifles and taking off our blaze orange, we went on to the most traditional of Tannersville post-hunting outings, the locally famous Snydersville Diner. Served by tenured waitresses wearing nurses' smocks and an old rail car, my grandparents both ordered a cup of coffee, while I asked for a hot chocolate with whipped cream on top. Even as I sipped the hot brew, I could see the old trees that shaded the parking lot and had to wonder if there was a deer watching me. I haven't been hunting since then. My grandparents were aging and I was busy with school, but it was a day in the grand cathedral of my ancestors that will always be dear to me. I'm Patrick Wagner.
Another popular tradition, book clubs, have thrived across the region. In December 1923, 13 African-American women in Charleston met to discuss their love of books. The Book Lovers of Charleston is celebrating its 90th anniversary this weekend. Yvonne Moore was asked to join the club 16 years ago and recently talked with West Virginia Public Radio's Beth Voorhees.
It absolutely is my favorite way to spend the fourth Sunday of every month.
Why? What do you get out of it?
It gives me an opportunity to read and to discuss books that probably would be sitting on my shelf for weeks with ladies of like kind who enjoy the intellectual portion of reading and over and above that, what I call titillating repartee, to talk about it after we've had the review. We have one reviewer each month. They review the book, and then we discuss it. And sometimes those discussions are very passionate, depending upon the subject matter and who's there at that particular meeting. But it's just a wonderful way to share the need and the love of books and what they bring to all of us.
The Book Lovers of Charleston was formed 90 years ago. That is extraordinary. It is.
Knowing those 13 ladies, they were women of letters. They were scholars. They were intellectual. They were educators. There was not a forum for them to get together. And maybe they discussed other things also, but primarily the intellectual role of books, they wanted that opportunity to share together, as women like to do. So there was no difference between 1923 and 2013, but to share something that they all had in common.
And the fact that it has remained all this time is testimony to the strength and the passion that you all have to include one another in these great discussions about literature, life, love, whatever kind of passion you bring to this.
And with the, especially over the 16 years that I have been a member, things have changed so much. We go from the economy to, of course, civil rights, women's rights, politics, of course, has been, you know, really, you know, up front.
Mm-hmm. Is it possible that the book lovers of Charleston will continue for another 90 years?
We certainly hope so. That's our plan. We have one member, Mrs. Mildred Ruth Holt, who has been a member. She goes back that she remembers many and has met of the original founding of the book lovers themselves. Mrs. Ruth Stevenson Norman, who died not too long ago, was the last remaining founder. I met her. She met me not too long after I came to Charleston in 72. So I can honestly say that I knew and visited her home and had tea with her back in the 70s. She is was an unbelievable name, educator in this valley.
Yvonne Moore of the Book Lovers of Charleston, congratulations on a 90th anniversary. So exciting. Let's see you back here for the 100th, all right?
I plan it. Thank you.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Seven West Virginia cities have been awarded a total of about $100,000 in grants aimed at boosting community health and economic development. State Commerce Secretary Keith Burdett announced the grants for projects that include plans for walking and bike trails, signs and decorative planters along walkways, community gardens, health programs, farmers markets, and a farm-to-restaurant program. Meanwhile, in Kentucky, Ashland City Commissioners will appoint a committee to look into the possibility of developing recreational trails on 45 acres that have been donated to the city by the late Charles and Betty Russell. 35 years ago, the couple bequeathed the land on either side of Ashland Avenue to the city with a stipulation that it be used for nature trails and a wildlife preserve. However, that's not happened. Mayor Chuck Charles says the city needs to gather input on the idea from residents of the neighborhood and craft a specific plan for the proposed new park.
Take all the concerns and take this property, look at it in detail with our engineering department and say, okay, where can we put these trails? You know, utilities, do we need to put anything else in there? Please, you know, let them look at it and just make a good broad look at it to see what we can do to build these hiking trails in the middle of Ashland.
Charles says a downtown park with walking trails would help in the city's battle with obesity. As the holidays are upon us, many of us will likely overindulge at parties, gatherings, and the dinner table. West Virginia Public Radio's Suzanne Higgins recently met with an ultra-marathoner whose age and message may inspire us to get out there for a run.
I think it was last fall, I was running down at Thurman and at a trail, and something black moved into my vision. I looked up, there's a big old bear, you know, 10, 12 feet in front of me. I set a new age group record that day. I so enjoy it.
That's where you'll often find 60-year-old Bill Warner of Beckley, running the trails in Thurmond or Grandview or another favorite wood somewhere in southern West Virginia. Bill is an ultra-marathoner, running up to 50-mile races and winning. Just this year, he won first place in his age group against 118 runners at the USA 25K Championships in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Then there was the Chicago Marathon, where Bill placed first in his age group of 510 runners and 769th out of the total 38,871 runners. He's also placed first in his age group repeatedly in the Charleston Distance Run.
I enjoy the competition. I have this thing that I will allow no one with gray hair to beat me.
Then there are his favorite races, the trail races, like the Mountain Masochist 50-mile trail race in Lynchburg, Virginia, where this year he won the Super Grandmasters Award for age 60 and over.
Trail running's my specialty, although I do compete in some of the major road races. Unfortunately, I'm good at road races, but I don't like them. They are very punishing on the body, and you're doing the same motion over and over again, and there's not much thinking in a road race. Where in a trail race, if you're not thinking about your next step, you're going to be eating dirt. You're going to trip. You're going to fall. Plus, nature always brings something. The peace, the quiet, no cars whizzing by. It's my stress reliever.
One of the things that's so remarkable about this extreme athlete is that he's only been running for 6 years after a 33-year hiatus.
In college, even though I made All-American, I partied my way through school. You know, I still graduated with honors. I still made All-American, but I quit running at my senior year. And when I come out of college, I was a highly functional alcoholic. You know, I missed a lot in my kids' life. I have three great kids and a wonderful wife who stuck by me. I got tired of that life. Actually, 10 years ago, my marriage was going downhill. You know, the kids tolerated me. And quite honestly, I got on my knees and I turned it over. And life is too precious to waste.
Bill runs almost every day now, even in the snow, and often with his entire family, including the dogs. He battled a lung infection that required major surgery 2 years ago, but remarkably came back even stronger in a 10K race just 3 months after the operation.
I felt no pain. I actually ran 2 minutes faster on the course than I did the year before. The good Lord looked after me through it all.
Bill knows this winter he'll be in Alabama for a 50-kilometer race, and then in Oregon for another 50K. And next spring, he'll be in Boston.
I have to do it after what happened last year. I have run the Boston Marathon several times, and last year I did not run it. I did not sign up. Didn't want to run it last year. My son was there. And as everyone knows what happened with the explosion, the people killed and maimed, and it really tore me deep inside. I'm looking at it as I'll run as a tribute to those that were injured, that lost their life, even those that didn't get a finish, and even those that did finish and carry that with them. So, yeah, it'll be special.
But for now, Bill is concentrating on a December 14th race in Chattanooga, a 50-mile run he'll complete in 9 to 10 hours. And he plans to return to Tennessee after the Boston Marathon for his first 100-mile race.
The way I view it, God gave me a gift, and I'm simply using that gift to His glory. I kid my wife that when it's time for me to go, I hope it's on a trail, someplace in the woods, enjoying what I truly love to do.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Suzanne Higgins in Beckley.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky, Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Petaway and Amy White from their CD Land of the Sky from Maggie's Music. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia, in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at our website, wvpublic.org. I'm Cecilia Mason. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.